Krasner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is Monday. My name is Beth Pike. And on today's edition, our host, Melvin Merritt, is going to be talking with Michelle Metge and also Robert Norris about Corey's Network. And Shelley's son, Corey, it was an unsolved murder that started them on a path of advocacy and the present need for donations and also volunteers. In the second half, our host Craig Lubow will be talking with Wyandotte County Sheriff Don Ash about new programs that they are developing under the juvenile justice reform efforts in Kansas. The preliminary plans to build the new juvenile detention center, and they'll also be talking about separating from the adult jail and a lot more. You'll also want to stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. But now it's going to be Melvin, his guest Shelley, and also Bob.
Good morning. Welcome to a live edition of Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1. I'm your host this morning, Melvin Merritt. And in the studio with me is, and if you would introduce yourself.
I'm Michelle Metge, otherwise known as Shelley.
And I'm Robert Norris.
Robert North. And we're going to be talking about Corey's Network Incorporated, as it was alluded as in the opening, and what happened with Corey D. Lakovich.
Yes.
And I'm going to assassinate that name probably, so I'm going to leave it alone and do just Corey. And so he was murdered July the 28th of 2013. And so tell us a little bit about the Corey Network.
Corey is our 22-year-old son, and his last name's been sacrificed many times, so don't worry about it. That's why we call it Corey's Network instead of putting his last name in it. He was 22. He was just out walking over by Independence Center from Quick Trip to our home, and someone stabbed him. Somehow he found his way home and into our house. And then, unfortunately, the first time he died in my arms. The last time, after being revived the fifth time he was unable to be revived because he was brain dead from a stroke. And that was on July 28th. The whole ordeal actually started on July 27th. When we came out after Corey was killed, my husband, Robert, and I, the first thing we asked was, where is our victim's advocate? Mm-hmm. And at that time, what they told us was that in the city of Independence, the police department does not have a victim's advocate. Once the crime was solved, we would then be given a Jackson County advocate, but not a city level advocate at any point. So unfortunately, that means since Corey's murder is still unsolved, we still don't have a victim's advocate.
I'm looking at one of your brochures with Corey's picture on it, and was it his age at that time when he was murdered?
Because
he looks real young.
He does.
Yeah. And you said, how old was he?
22
years old. And we know that this is happening all throughout Kansas City and the Metroplex, that murders of children, young people. And so, and then we have a guest of yours in the studio, and I'm sure that he's probably have experienced something like this as well.
This is my husband.
Oh, okay then. So, well, he know firsthand.
Yes.
We went through the whole ordeal. It was life-changing. It really was.
Tell me this. Are they still investigating? Is it a cold case, or have they found the person that have...
It's still unsolved. Mm-hmm. Independence does not consider any case cold. So therefore, they'll work it just like it's any other case. So if evidence or anything is found up to this point, they'll send out the entire team and work it like it's a brand new case.
I see.
But unfortunately, it is unsolved, and we're not sure if it's ever going to be solved.
Tell me this now. We have ad hoc group against crime in the inner city. Now,
yes.
Are they working on this case or putting up a ward to help out on this murder?
Ad hoc group, we've been invited to do another show with them in just a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And so they work with us as far as trying to get Corey's name out there. They also have a $1,000 reward. On the tips hotline, though, we have raised enough that there's a $9,000 reward.
Mm.
So if someone comes forward, then potentially they could get a $10,000 reward with both of those together.
I see that you have a 501c3 profit, nonprofit organization out of this.
Right.
And so you are keeping this, at least his death, alive. And by doing what other things?
Like I said, when we came out, we realized there were no advocacy programs in our area. We did a little bit more research, and we found out that most of the metropolitan police departments do not have an advocate on the police level. That was due to the recession in 2009 when they had to get rid of all their non-essential personnel. So I'd already been in social work for over 25 years,
mm-hmm.
And I have 2 master's degrees. So I'm very experienced in advocacy and in case management and et cetera. So
mm-hmm.
Bob and I decided to revamp my career, because up to that point I'd actually worked with the criminals and gang members and dropouts and et cetera. And we decided instead we would work with the victims, and we created Corey's Network, which is a 501c3.
Okay.
We have a board of directors that is a working board of directors with 160 years of experience in areas such as nursing and EMT, law. We've got professors, et cetera. Bob's got 37 years in the corporate world. He kind of herds the cats, as he puts it.
Mm.
And then, you know, with mine now, it's 28 years in social work. The head of our advocacy program, he's actually been with the Department of Mental Health for 25.
Oh, you have a lot of experience behind you.
Yes,
but
we
tell
do.
Tell me this. Now, we talked briefly on the phone,
mm-hmm.
and you was telling me about other victims and what you do in terms of helping them out.
What we do is we've created an advocacy program.
Mm-hmm.
We will go to any precinct that does not have an advocate. All they have to do is ask for our help. We don't do ambulance chasing, so we're not going to come to them. They're going to have to come to us, because that way we know that we're not getting involved in the investigation or hurting anything. What we do is we help connect people to counseling. We help them understand the investigation. We help them navigate the media. We help them fill out and take care of their crime victims' compensation, which will help with $5,000 of reimbursement from the state for a homicide victim, for their funeral, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have funds, and we do fundraising for victims so that we can help actually pay for the funerals of homicide victims.
Now, this is new to me. How does this work in conjunction with Ad Hoc Group Against Crime? And are they doing some of these same things, or is it just that Corey's death had pulled this type of service out?
Ad Hoc is doing a wonderful job. They uh-huh. mostly work in the Kansas City metropolitan, you know, Kansas City proper.
Mm-hmm.
We work more in the eastern Jackson County area. So we do some of the same things that they do. However, we also work together.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a murder here in Kansas City and they need funds for a funeral, Ad Hoc will contact us and say there's a family out here that needs help with funds for the funeral, because that's something that they don't do.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Right. Yeah. One of my master's degrees is in fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the things that we needed for our program, as well as for other people. So we can go out into the community and do fundraisers for the homicide victims. And we may have the money in our bank account, or we may have to do a fundraiser for them And then specifically that money would go directly to that family.
But so, in other words, you know, I would like to encourage people that have lost loved ones to get on the bandwagon with you, especially when you do your fundraising. And speaking of fundraising, you just had a fundraiser. Tell us a little bit about that.
We have a quarterly fundraiser at Chuck E. Cheese in Independence. Mm-hmm. And Chuck E. Cheese actually approached us when we were out. We were raising gift certificates and et cetera for a raffle and silent auction. And the fundraising manager out there, her name's Jade Reynolds, she came to us and said, we would really like to do a quarterly fundraiser with you. And what they do is for every person that comes in, 15% of their purchase goes to Corey's Network for an evening. And it goes from 3 to 9 o'clock on the night that we do it. And those funds are earmarked for people that are under the age of 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So one example is that a woman came out to our fundraiser. This was two fundraisers ago. And she talked to us for about 30 minutes, asked us about our program. And she said, well, God bless you. I'll be praying for you. And, you know, I'll keep you in my thoughts. And
in
she
prayers,
said,
yeah.
Right. And she said, good luck to you. 3 weeks later, she called and she said that it was her little brother who was the four-year-old that was murdered. And she needed our help. So it was kind of like God saying, you don't know what's going to come up your way, but I know what's coming and I'm preparing that way. So she was able to be part of the fundraiser and then be able to benefit from it. And so it was a really moving time for us because we realized the connection.
I can tell. Let's get your husband into this and let's find out what he is doing.
Basically, I support all the efforts that we do. I mean, I'm usually in the background. You know, I'm driving around and I'm, you know, getting her where she needs to go. But this year, we've helped 14 families with their finances on funerals. And three of those have been the children that you've seen a lot in the news.
In the news.
Yeah. We go anywhere. We try to help anybody that needs help. This has been a very, very remarkable and humbling experience for me because I've never done this before. You know, I've been in the corporate world, meetings, reports, and all that kind of stuff. So this is a different side of the whole experience that I've been going through. And it's been very humbling.
So you've been thrust into this, you know,
yes,
so to speak. Yeah.
But I find that a lot of the skills that I have, you know, insofar as organization and trying to keep things straight has helped me and helped our organization through getting through the whole journey.
You know, I don't know which one would be best to answer this question, but I see on your brochure what it talks about documented training. What is that? What does that entail?
What we did is the first year that we were together, we went through and we talked to as many people as we could. We talked to the media. We had the people from Jeff City come out. We talked to everybody that we could so that we were up to speed on how things are supposed to be run and how things should go. So that when we were out in the public or we were, you know, doing some of the things we do, each and every member could represent ourselves well.
Okay. So that means that they would have to have some type of documented training.
Yes.
And
we,
those types of things.
What we try to do is we keep all the training that we do in a document so that if called upon, you know, we know that this person has this kind of training, this person has that kind of training, so that we're not sending people out to a site and the
they
person's
don't know what
not,
they're doing.
Yeah, they don't know what they're doing.
Right. And so are these people are coming on board that have already have the training or had the training in this particular thing that you're interested in them sending them out?
Actually, what each one of our board members has a different set of skills that they brought to the table. Mm-hmm. An EMT, someone who works for the courts, a chiropractor / professor, a treasurer. We've got, you know, Department of Mental Health, et cetera. So each one of them have different trainings.
So you reach out into the professional community.
We've reached out into the professional community. And interestingly, all of the people on our board also have a connection to Corey. So they had a personal investment in making this successful. But what we did on top of that is that we actually brought the representative from the state of Missouri, from Jefferson City, to a board meeting and had her cross-train everyone on the board so that everyone on the board would know how to do crime victims compensation. And then we had the victims advocate from Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas. Both of those came out to our board meeting as well and trained us on their advocacy procedures and how to deal with families, etc. Then we also had someone from the media, from one of the television news stations, that came to our home and taught us how to deal with the media as far as what a family should not say, and how to best handle it if they don't want to talk to the media or if they would like to have a press conference. And so they trained us. Every person on the board of directors received this training. So we have documentation of the training that they received before they became a board member, and then we have the documentation of the training that we've done since then as a group.
Have any of these board members have experienced a loss in their own personal family, or is it that's not important? Which one?
Actually, all of them are connected to Corey in some way.
Okay.
So we do have my sister that is his aunt, my brother-in-law that's his uncle, two of his teachers that were his teachers at Wright Career College. Then, every person, and the person that's with the Department of Mental Health, his name is Dennis. I've known him since 1983. So he's known Corey throughout his life. So every person on the board of directors has a personal connection with the murders.
While I'm thinking about it, give us your hotline, because I see you have a hotline here. Go ahead and give us that number.
You can call us at 816-834-9161. That's 24 hours a day. It rings to at least one board member, if not two or three, so that it will always be answered. And if it's not answered, leave a message. That means that we're actually on the phone with someone else. As far as the hotline is concerned, we will answer it 24 hours a day. So if somebody's working in a hospital and they know that somebody's just suffered from a homicide, they can give our phone number of 816-834-9161 to that person, and we'll be able to help them through the crime victims compensation and advocacy.
Remember, if you're just now tuning in, this is Jaws of Justice. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and in the studio with me is Miss Michelle Metchie and Mr. Robert Norris Metchie, if I could say it like that, because they are married. So, in a way, we're talking about Corey's Network Incorporated, and it's a nonprofit organization, and they have a hotline, and you said you have a website, right?
Yes, we do. It's Corey'sNetwork.org, and if anyone is interested in seeing what we do, there's a specific article about how our money is spent, so people can understand how we use it. Mm-hmm. There's also an article that we've researched how much it costs to put someone in a funeral. So, in other words, how much does homicide really cost the family once it's happened? But on one of our pages, it's Contact Us. If you'd like to volunteer,
that's what I was going to ask.
If you would like to donate, if you would like to come to one of our fundraisers or anything else, we suggest that you go to Corey'sNetwork.org and fill in the Contact Us form, and it'll go directly to myself, and we will add you to our email list, or we'll contact you in any way that you need it. So if somebody actually needs our help as well, you can contact us that way.
Now, what if an individual would like to volunteer? Now, would they have to go through any type of training or any of those kinds of things? What would be the first thing that they would have to do?
The first thing that they would have to do is contact us and let us know what area they're interested in. Mm-hmm. If there's someone who's just interested in bringing food to families or something like that, then there's not much training that would be involved in that. Or if they're just wanting to help set up for a fundraiser, that's not much training.
Right.
However, our head of advocacy is going to be running some trainings that would have our volunteers a little bit more involved in doing candle vigils or going to the home and talking with individuals. But that training would go directly through our head of advocacy. Because like I said, he has worked for Department of Mental Health for 25 years. So he's a very well-versed man. So
I think this is really unique, and especially with all the professionals behind you and setting up training, because a lot of times when people are thrust into situations like this, that, you know, they just get out and do it, you know, without any type of training, because they're running basically on emotions and how they feel. And now that you are really kind of adding something to this, and this is unique, and it's kind of new to me in terms of hearing a parent or parents that is setting up things like this. This is a model, if you will. And so some of the other things that you would like to let our audience know about Corey and the situation that you guys are in.
Corey, like I said, his murder is still unsolved. Part of the reason is what we understand from the police is that an entire apartment building heard him yelling for help. But no one will come forward and say that they actually saw what happened or know who killed my son. Our community is killing itself. Mm. It really is. And it doesn't matter if you're black or you're white or you're Hispanic. It does not matter.
That's right. A life is a life.
A life is a life. And what's going on, though, is people are, it's called the bystander effect. And people think, well, I can just stand back because someone else is going to come forward. I don't have to be the one to speak up. And we really have to stop doing that. And we have to be the person who will say, I will come and help if that's what's necessary. We've got to stop keeping the silence. Someone defined the difference between a snitch and a witness. A snitch is somebody who's trying to get themselves out of trouble.
Right.
And a witness is somebody that saw something happen, and
they're tired of it.
They're tired of it. Mm-hmm. And I think people need to quit thinking that they're snitching if they tell somebody that a murder has occurred.
Sure. We only have about a minute and a half for the end of this broadcast, but we want to make sure that we give this information out in case someone just tuned in and want to do something with the Corey Network. Give us that information again real quick.
Our hotline number is 816-834-9161. And our website is Corey's Network, CoreysNetwork.org.
Remember, you've been listening to this on KKFI 90.1. I have been your host, Melvin Merritt, and we were in the studio talking to Michelle Metcha and Robert North, her husband. So I hope you go out and have a great day. And remember to listen to KKFI 90.1.
Now, the calendar for August 29th. The Kansas City chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, September 2nd, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. This month's guest speaker is Ramona Quinn, a certified survival skills for women and trauma-informed care trainer. She will tell you about trauma-informed care and how to begin the implementation process in your work. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, September 2nd, beginning at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, KCMO. POMC makes the difference through an ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness. They meet to provide support and assistance to all survivors of homicide victims while working to create a world free of murder. Are you looking to be a mentor? High Aspirations has a mentoring program designed to help African American males 8 to 18. And they need men to volunteer so they can reach more young men. Mentor training and support are provided with as little as 2 hours a week commitment. For more information, call 816-305-3334 or email admin, that's with a capital A, admin at highaspirationskc.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Tune in next week when we replay an interview Keith Brownell did with Max Parthas of New Abolitionist Radio, who will be here in Kansas City next month as the keynote speaker at the Missouri Cure Conference. Coming up next is Craig and his guest, Wyandotte County Sheriff Don Ash.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and as Jeff mentioned, my guest today is Sheriff Don Ash from Wyandotte County. He has an Associate's of Arts degree in Criminal Justice from KCK Community College and BA in Management of Human Relations from Mid-America Nazarene University. He's been law enforcement from 1972 through 2006 with the KCK Police Department, and then was elected sheriff in 2009. We're going to talk about today the Juvenile Justice Reform Act in Kansas. So, welcome, Don.
Well, thank you, Craig, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on and visit with folks.
All right. Let me have you start, for those who aren't familiar with the act, if we spend 3 or 4 minutes just summarizing what it does.
Well, Senate Bill 367 was a reform in the Juvenile Justice Act for the state of Kansas, and really seeks to, I think, basically lower the overall population of youth who are in custody, and particularly secure custody or a group home custody in the state of Kansas, and rather redirecting them and managing them outside of secure detention in order to help them get back on a correct and a productive path in their life so that it reduces recidivism, they don't reoffend and move from offender status as a juvenile and as they attain adulthood.
Okay. And how many youth are incarcerated in Kansas?
In the state of Kansas, I don't know. I can tell you in Wyandotte County, when I first became sheriff in the juvenile detention center, in secure detention, our average daily population 2009-2010 was about 42. That has gone down each year since I have been there. And I can tell you this morning, I think we have probably 22 that are in custody today. We went into the weekend with only 17 or 18 in custody. So we have seen those numbers reducing in Wyandotte County, but they still remain pretty high.
Yeah. I saw, and I didn't see the precise numbers, but rankings, and I think Kansas was somewhere in the top six for incarcerating youth after adjudication, whether that be group homes or the youth centers. What kind of percentage have they suggested? What percentage drop this new act might achieve?
Well, I think they're trying to reduce that overall population by 50% minimum or more. I think that's a pretty good stretch goal.
One of the things that I had Micah Kubik on from ACLU a few weeks ago, and he mentioned that one of the things it does is supposedly is to ban incarceration of youths that only have misdemeanor convictions. that they wouldn't be able to go to the youth center. Right now, you know, there's certain stages they have to go through, but if they only have a misdemeanor, they could eventually end up in the youth center, whereas with the new act, they would have to be a felony. Is that your understanding of that?
Yes, that's my understanding. And, of course, we hold them pretrial or pre-adjudication. Right. So then what happens to them post-adjudication is up to those folks on the back end of that system.
Okay. We talked about before we came in, part of what needs to happen in the figures I saw was that they're going to need to spend $70 million over, I think it was a five-year period, to make this happen. I think it said they saved $70 million. But there's a gap between what they'll save and what they have to spend. Do you see this with the legislative issues we've had as happening, or you think they'll find the funding?
Well, I certainly hope they find the funding. the $72 million, I think, is a goal they're trying to achieve over a five-year period reduction. If they're able to cut that population by 50%, I think that's probably how they're coming up with that. But then the stated goal of the legislature that passed this legislation was that money would be, a portion of it, would be redirected into the communities that needed it to be able to provide this alternate funding. That certainly will be a key component for Wyandotte County. As one of the five major counties in the state, compared to Sedgwick, Shawnee, even Douglas, and Johnson County, Wyandotte County does not have the same capacity, and we currently don't have the level of resources I think we would need to be able to deal with these offenders in the way that the legislation is proposing. And I think that is a concern. I know it is a concern for our prosecutor's office, somewhat of a concern for law enforcement as well, because those will be key components to the success of these stated goals and outcomes of the legislation.
Assuming that they come up with the funding and that they spend the money, and of course they're going to have to come up with some money up front before the savings start to accrue. If they do that, what are the positive things about this act besides just moving them out of incarceration? What are the benefits to the youth and to the community?
Well, I think certainly if these offenders, as they're just beginning to offend and they are young, if they have the opportunity, they and their families, to be directed into some community resources that are able to help them develop the skills that they need and the strategies that they need in order to redirect these youth away from offending, whatever that might be, that's a good thing to help people be, you know, productive, contributing members in the community, in the society. You know, the other thing is it is very costly to have people, whether they're juveniles or adults, in secure detention. And sometimes I think we take, younger offenders or early offenders, and we put them in with some who are probably ones that need to be incarcerated, who are the ones who are have a tendency to violence, those other kinds of things, to be predatory. And now we're exposing these newer ones, you know, to them. And so I don't think that's, you know, certainly in the best interest of a lot of the people that end up in secure detention sometimes. Of course, you know, if we're able to achieve the desired outcomes, I believe the outcomes, the goals and the objectives of this legislation, the desired outcomes can be achieved. And if it can reduce that overall cost by $72 million over a five-year period, that makes everything more effective, you know, more efficient, and it's in the best interest of these young people and their families, and actually helping them get what they need in order to overcome these obstacles.
One of the things I understand is that they're going to phase out group homes. Is that going to, could that end up being counterproductive in that if we want to keep the youth from having to be incarcerated in the youth centers, and if reintegration with the family is not possible, you know, with adults, you don't have to worry about, we don't have to send them back to the family. With children, you can't just turn them out on the street. So without the group home option, what will they do? Will they just, I mean, the only thing I can think of would be potentially they would have to have a companion child in need of care case and treat them as children in need of care.
Well, that may certainly be an option. And then you're going to put, you know, somebody who's obviously struggling with what these stated goals and desires are, and we're going to put them in with children in need of care who, by and large, they're victims, you know, of one way or another. And so I don't know how effective that, you know, really could be. Or, you know, judges will determine, well, you need to be in secure detention, and then that will be counterproductive and counter to the goal of reducing, you know, these populations.
When this was all being hashed out in the legislature, I had read that afterward the District Attorneys Association over there complained that none of the prosecutors were consulted by the legislature. Well, I kind of, I don't know if that's accurate. But I mean, that would be a first that they didn't consult them. But in terms of law enforcement, did they consult law enforcement community?
Well, I have read that through legislative committee or some process that there were multidisciplinary groups, including county attorneys, including law enforcement, that were consulted, you know, in the process, in addition to the private providers that present these programs and so on and so forth. I've looked at the Pew Research and some research that the Vera Institute has done as well, and they all advocate and promote the multidisciplinary approach. But I'm not sure to what extent that occurred. And so I did have an opportunity to see a letter that the County Attorneys Association presented to the legislature, to the committee, in testimony, and there were some pretty well thought out objections that were outlined and detailed in there, probably six or eight of them, as I recall, and some of those would be concerned that law enforcement would have too, in that our main mission is public safety, you know, and to protect the community. And the fact of the matter is there are just a certain number of people that don't belong in polite society with everybody else based on their current patterns of behavior and activities that they're involved mm-hmm. in. So we are looking anxiously to see how this, you know, will play out. And I'm committed in Wyandotte County, and we have been working on a juvenile detention alternatives initiative with a working group of stakeholders from Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas, multidisciplinary. It includes the judges, the prosecutors, the schools, police department, sheriff's office, community corrections, and private providers of some of these programming. And I think that's why we have seen some of the reduction in the average daily population in mm-hmm. in Wyandotte County, you know, in Kansas City, Kansas. So it's an ongoing work, and I think people will have to be committed to it and dedicated to it. And like anything else, we'll need to adjust course as we see what actually develops.
A lot of the services have been provided, and gosh, it's been more than 10 years now, that have been privatized in Kansas. Has that had an impact? I know the issue of privatized prisons has come up, and to survive, they have to keep promoting you know, higher incarceration rates because of their profit motive. Is that to some extent true? Is that happen? Do you see that happening with the social service agencies that have been privatized? Like the one that comes to mind in Wyandotte County would be Kaw Valley. Is that having an adverse impact?
You know, I've never really looked at that, Craig, so I don't know. I've never heard anybody mention that or talk about it or that anybody's, you know, brought forward any data, you know, to look at and suggest that. And that would probably be something to look at.
In terms of the services, the community-based services that this act envisions, what are some of the specific things that the act would promote or that the police departments and sheriff departments would be involved in? What kind of services might be funded where they can help assure that this is implemented?
You don't know, I don't know that I've seen anything in there that suggests that. Our role, and particularly my role, is in keeping them in secure detention pre-adjudication or until their case works its way through the court. From that aspect of it, I haven't seen anything. The other thing that we do in Wyandotte County, which is unique to all the other counties or the judicial districts in Kansas, is the sheriff's office is responsible for running juvenile intake and assessment. Now, we will see a significant impact there. And we are the only sheriff's office in the state that oversees juvenile intake and assessment or in any other judicial district. So increasingly, it will become the front door where these offenders will be screened and determinations based on risk assessment instruments developed off of best practices and the stated goals and objectives of this legislation to redirect these offenders out of secure detention and into these programs. So we're working diligently on that with our group of juvenile alternatives initiatives, juvenile detention alternative initiatives, and our juvenile judges to perfect that instrument so that we correctly redirect people. And that will be one that we will be involved in on a daily basis. We have in Wyandotte County over 500 youth a year that come through juvenile intake and assessment. Most of those are children in need of care or police protective custody cases. But now this legislation directs them to the offenders to come there before going to detention. And so we're working hard on that piece of it.
What percentage of those of the 500 actually are kids that wind up in detention?
It's a relatively small percentage of those. Most of those 500 are children in need of care. Mm-hmm. But even when the police arrest somebody for an offense that the statute says they can be incarcerated for, we still have to send a screener there to do a juvenile intake and assessment screen on that juvenile for the court.
I think back when we were younger, we're close to same age. When we were kids, if there was a problem with the child and they did something, it might be a crime if they were an adult. Most of the times, the first thing that would happen is the police officer would take the kid to their home and have a talk with the parents first. Why doesn't that happen anymore?
Well,
I'm not going to say it doesn't happen at all, but it's certainly not like it was when we were young.
You know, once again, changes over the years in legislation, you know, and then the statutes that say, you know, you need to take these youth and you need to screen them to find out what's, you know, really going on. Sometimes you find out before you talk to parents that maybe there are dynamics in play in the youth's home or in the relationship with the parents. You know, we have a lot of blended families anymore. We have a lot of split families anymore. And there are just a lot of things going on in the lives of our young people. And so, you know, most of the time that's what happens. I won't say that parents are never, you know, contacted, or that either come to the scene or they contact the parents and talk with the parents. That still happens now, but in large measure, legislation often requires that you take them to JIAC and that they be screened and assessed, and then they may be released to parents or grandparents or other family members from there. But that the screening needs to be done so that the court or the Department of Children and Families has the information that they need to do adequate follow-up and see what's really going on in this young person's life.
Now, is it, part of that is, are kids these days more violent, the offenders that are? I don't think most kids are, but are the offenders becoming more violent, or is it just the different way of reacting to them?
Well, I think, you know, certainly we have seen an increase in violence, you know, from young people all around our country, and even to a lesser extent in, you know, in our own area. And so, once again, there are a lot of dynamics that are going on. We have seen abuse rates of juveniles, you know, increase. Mm-hmm. We've seen teen pregnancy rates increase. You know, there are a lot of things going on, and sometimes at the hands of people who are primary caregivers for a lot of these youth. And so I think in response and reaction to that, and public outcry that, well, they called the police, but they didn't do anything, or they notified the state, or they notified the authorities, and they didn't do anything, is what has driven a lot of these changes in legislation requiring these screens, you know, such as are done in juvenile intake and assessment.
In terms of, from a law enforcement perspective, are there like one to two programs that you think, if you were able to choose what programs would take priority, are there one to two programs that you would say would be the most helpful?
Well, from a law enforcement perspective, I'd like to see us get a lot more engaged in early intervention. I think a lot of the research, I come from a background of back in the late 80s or early 90s, we implemented the DARE program in Kansas City, Kansas Police Department, Kansas City, Kansas, throughout all schools in Kansas City, Kansas, elementary schools, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education Program. All of the research indicates that there's got to be early intervention in developing these positive relationships between police and community, police and youth, and also in giving them information and building social coping skills to be able to resist things like drugs and violence and gangs and so on and so forth. And then after about 10 years into it, it became necessary to, you know, to let that go. And I think that's more, you know, programs like that. From a law enforcement perspective, what we can do in law enforcement is we can help do that. You know, that can be our piece.
What's the reason why they let the DARE program go?
It always comes down to, you know, basically funding.
Okay.
What funding is available and where are the resources needed at any given time. And the decision was made that those resources need to be redirected, you know, other ways. And then there was a move toward the school resource officer program. But that's a program geared for high school students. And all of the research suggests you've got to get in early.
What kind of interaction do you see under the new act between law enforcement and the social service agencies in the courts? You mentioned interdisciplinary. So what's the one thing that you think needs to happen to make sure that all of those components come together?
Well, I think this early screening is key. We have to get that right. And we have to be sure we're directing the youth into the right resources. So as we do the screening, it's got to be good. It's got to be complete, accurate. If law enforcement's going to be doing it, we need to become very skilled at it. And so that we give those judges, prosecutors, those people are going to make decisions about where they're going to direct these youth, that they get them directed into the correct programming.
Do you see, or do you think there's anything we can do that gets to these families when the kids are real young something that would be community-wide, whether it be through the school or something, to work to assure that parents in Wyandotte County and elsewhere have the parenting skills to steer their kids in the right direction.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge advocate for early childhood education, early home visitation programs for parents to help them have the skills and the information and so forth necessary to help their children be successful and certainly be school ready. I work through an organization called the Family Conservancy, and in fact, a national organization, Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. I'm going to Washington next month to serve on a panel that will brief legislators, congressmen, their aides in the importance of helping those very things come about. And I think it's research shows it's less costly to invest early and upfront, because the costs on the back end and the criminal justice system and incarceration are huge.
All right. For those of you just joining us, we have been talking with Sheriff Don Ash from Wyandotte County. We've been talking about the new juvenile justice reform, which is the first major reform in Kansas, I think, in more than 20 years. And I want to thank you for joining us. And next, I believe, is the 420 Drug News?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
You've heard many mentions of Michelle Alexander. She's been at many conferences, been called upon for her knowledge, and to recount her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, and it is my privilege, heck, a distinct honor, to once again welcome Michelle Alexander. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
You have made a difference. You have awakened politicians and pundits. You have given many people reason to re-examine this policy of drug war, have you not?
Well, that was certainly my hope and prayer in writing the book, that it would help to lead to an awakening about what we as a nation have done in this drug war, particularly to poor communities of color. There's so much mythology about the drug war, its history, its reasons, its consequences, and I hoped that by pulling back the curtain and offering some history data and closer analysis, that it would help to have others achieve the same awakening about the cruelty of this drug war that I finally did.
Well, even the NAACP has kind of embraced the knowledge that you've relayed as well, along with other organizations. Am I right?
Yeah, you know, when I first started writing this book, I was dismayed that so many of our nation's civil rights organizations were not making ending the war on drug a top priority, given the devastating consequences of the war in poor communities of color, not just by imprisoning millions of folks, but by branding them criminals and felons and rendering them permanent second-class citizens, you know, stripped of the right to vote, you know, automatically excluded from juries and legally discriminated against, denied the very right supposedly won in the civil rights movement. And what I've just been so gratified by is that over the years, since I began writing the book and since it's been released, many of the leading civil rights organizations, including the NAACP, are devoting more time, attention, and resources to the issue. And the NAACP did adopt a resolution condemning the drug war and putting the, you know, organization officially on record as opposing it. So there are signs that things are moving in the right direction, but I fear that there is still not enough being done at a grassroots level to mobilize public opinion.
Again, that was the amazing Michelle Alexander. I'm Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.